The Blaze Radio Network. On demand. Glenn Beck.
I wanted to share a letter with you that came in that was unusual. I've been saying for a while, the minute we start to try to win is the minute we lose. By trying to win and winning, it means that everybody else loses. It's why we need reconciliation. We need reconciliation with each other, and we need it with the truth. We don't need wins. We need an honest search for truth. How can we make life better? How can we solve things? And how can we do it together? Now, that doesn't mean we're going to agree on everything, and it doesn't mean that everybody's going to join in. But there has to be some effort made. I got this email in, and I wanted to share it. Dear Mr. Beck, I never thought I would be writing to you, especially not to thank you for anything, but here I am. As a 23-year-old liberal who was pretty politically aware throughout middle and high school, you once represented one of the biggest problems our country had to me. But after listening to you, I have felt something I haven't felt in a long time. Hope. True, honest to God, hope. Hope for the future of this country. Not the kind of partisan hope that, quote, my team wins, end quote, but the kind of hope that we can all figure out that we're all on the same team, the American team. I had honestly given up, Mr. Beck. American politics were beyond saving in my eyes. But if Glenn freaking Beck, of all people, can come out and extend an olive branch and try to start building a bridge between the two Americas, then I know I shouldn't give up. Please don't try to stop fixing this. You're going to take flack from both sides. The right is going to call you a traitor, and the left will call you a liar. But you will have my support, and you'll have the support of everyone else who is fed up with the constant war of outrage and scandal. Thank you. Let me just reply, no, thank you, Max.
It's Wednesday, February 28th. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
So we all have to look at what we can do in our own lives to make the world a better place. I know that Ben Shapiro has come out, and on the Daily Wire, he has said, we are not going to publish the name or the likeness and make this kid in Florida famous. And we have said that for a long time. We don't use the name on the radio. The Blaze has not had an official policy on that. And I really want an official policy on it, but I want it rooted in things that actually have some backing to it. What really does make a difference? If the media would do certain things, would that help? Well, there is a guy who has studied this for a long time, Ari Shulman. He is the editor of the New Atlantis, and he has a Wall Street Journal article out, What Mass Killers Want and How to Stop Them. Ari, can you help me design a policy for our media outlet so we don't help mass killers?
Well, I can try. Thank you for having me on the show, first of all. So I've been writing about this issue for a few years, and what I did was I just looked into the psychology and criminology research that has been around for about 20 or 25 years on mass killings, and I was trying to look at this question of what motivates them. And the answer is that there are a lot of different things that motivate them individually. They all have some sort of grievance. The main commonality is that they all get to a point where they decide that the world is to blame for whatever they are frustrated about in their own lives. And they want to inflict their rage upon the world in a kind of spectacle of theatrical public violence. And one of the commonalities of that is that they feel a sense of frustration and impotence, that they don't have any control over their lives and they don't have any meaning in their lives. And so this act in which they usually intend to die is a way of trying to give their lives a kind of final meaning. And part of that is to create a sort of infamy for themselves and for their action. So there is a wealth of evidence that shows that mass killers, especially after Columbine, are obsessed with previous events. A lot of them are obsessed with Columbine. Many of them became obsessed with the Virginia Tech shootings. there becomes this kind of chain of obsessive interest in each other. The Newtown shooter, for example, actually kept a spreadsheet where he was keeping track of all of the mass shootings that had happened and the details on them, which had the highest body counts and so forth. And so there is a lot of evidence that what's happening here is that there are these, there's this class of frustrated young men who are essentially trying to one-up each other, to outdo each other, and that part of that is their desire to create a kind of infamy for themselves in their death.
Okay, so you, let's just take this list one by one. You say never publish the shooter's propaganda.
Yes. So I think the worst example of this would be the Virginia Tech shooting, where the shooter, actually minutes before he committed his act, dropped in the mail to NBC News a video that he had created where he was ranting about the world and all of the people who had wronged him and how he was about to get his revenge. I think that it is really appropriate to view this as a form of propaganda. Mass shootings in general, I think, can be understood as a form of apolitical terrorism. It's terrorism without any very strong political content, but it is still designed to inflict terror upon society and to target innocent victims. So when you publish that kind of propaganda or manifestos or any of that kind of stuff, the Sutherland Springs shooter left a manifesto, you are allowing them to control the meaning of that event. And what that does is that creates a motive or an incentive for the next shooter to know, well, if I go and do a big enough shooting, then I will get to control the meaning of that event and my words will get out there and I'll become a kind of anti-hero.
And I assume you'd say the same thing about terror. I mean, you know, actual Islamic Middle Eastern terrorism.
Yes, I think that that's right. I mean, I've studied mass shootings a little bit more than actual political terrorism.
Sure.
But that is the aim of the terrorist is not to actually destroy his enemy physically. It's to inflict a kind of psychological triumph where the victim is made to feel powerless in this event. And part of that is crafting a kind of narrative around that. And I think that that is a commonality with mass shootings.
So hide their names and faces, but is the next one. But I want to jump to this one. Don't report on biography or speculate on motive. That in this particular case, the biography or the history of this kid has been extraordinarily valuable to figure out what happened.
Yeah, so of all of the things that I wrote in this piece, I wrote this piece about 4 years ago. That's the one that I would probably the most want to walk back from now. I think what I would say about that is that there's often an excessive focus on trying to find out what is the motive for this person. There's always this question. People describe these as this is senseless. There doesn't seem to be a reason that this person killed the particular victims that he did. And my answer to that is that the motive it should be understood as kind of self-directed and as a desire to just get infamy and notoriety for oneself. When people are asking about motive, they're usually trying to find out, you know, did the particular victims actually wrong the perpetrator in some way? And the whole point of these acts is that the victims didn't even really know the perpetrator. The perpetrator is deliberately trying to kill innocent victims. And so I think that there can be an excessive focus on trying to make sense of these acts and kind of in the terms of sort of normal crime where there is a deliberate targeting. So I think that's what I was trying to get at with that one. Obviously, in this case, the reporting on his biography has been extremely valuable. So I think I would put a little asterisk around that now.
The minimize specifics and gory details and kind of the no photos and videos of the event, I think these are kind of explained together that, you know, we're not looking for photos and videos that are gory or that glorify or show in action the shooters. But for instance, you know, having pictures of the scene, let's take Las Vegas. I don't even know what the shooter really looked like. And we didn't see any videos of him except in the window. Should we have done the videos of the scene as it was going, but not showing the shooter?
What I'll say about this is just that I want to recommend that there is a balancing act to be had. I think particularly when you look at past shootings, Columbine is the biggest example of this. I think part of the reason that Columbine had such an outsized influence, and there have been journalists and criminologists who have tracked this and found that probably something like 60 or 70 mass shootings have been directly or indirectly inspired by Columbine, where there is a kind of line of obsessive influence from the shooters back to Columbine. I think a lot of that had to do with the imagery that came out of that. So anybody who was, you know, around and paying attention to the news reporting at the time, as I was, saw these video camera images, the security camera images in the school of the two shooters walking around the school, and it created this mm-hmm. really iconic imagery of these shooters perpetrating this act. So there is obviously a value in reporting on the details of the act. It's particularly valuable when people are trying to figure about policy mechanisms for disrupting this. What kind of weapons did they use? How did it all play out? There are still a lot of questions about the details of what happened in Las Vegas, for example. There is that value there. The point that I want to make is that there is also a risk in doing that of allowing for the creation of iconography that will go on and inspire future shooters.
Yes. Talking to Ari Shulman of the New Atlantis, he also wrote in the Wall Street Journal about and studied for a long time mass shootings. I have kind of a working theory here, Ari. Tell me if you can help me along with this. But the Vegas incident is a very strange one when you group it in with all these other mass shootings. And I feel like we almost, in a way, the media was forced into taking your recommendations and essentially experimenting whether they would work or not.
Yes.
Because we didn't have a motive. We didn't have any video of him doing anything. And my belief is, at this point, you could go back and name the Columbine killers and people would have them right off the top of their heads. Who this guy was in Vegas is basically...
I know nothing about him.
We know it's a terrible incident. We know generally what happened, but he was not made into a celebrity out of that. And it's the biggest mass shooting in American history, at least going back several decades. It seems like there's almost a test case here to show that your ideas here actually work.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. So again, I first started writing about this a few years ago. I've written a few follow-up pieces since, and the biggest thing that I wrote about this was this big Wall Street Journal piece, and I would probably write it a little bit differently today. I was very much focused on the infamy and sort of celebrity aspect, and I was particularly thinking about Columbine, Virginia Tech, Newtown, and a bunch of the acts that had tried to imitate those, where there was very, very clear evidence that a desire for infamy and celebrity was part of the motivation. Some of the more recent acts, it's less clear. I think Las Vegas is one of those. The recent shooting in Parkland, it's less clear there. I think the same thing for Sutherland Springs. I can name a few other examples.
So what would you add to what would you add to this list? There's some things that you said, I might rethink that. Is there anything you'd add to this list?
I don't know that I would add to this exactly. One of the things that I would say is that there is a way to get the information out there in a less sensational manner. So when you look at the initial reporting after a mass shooting in the first few days, a vast amount of the information turns out to be wrong. And the way that we respond to it, part of what I was trying to get at in this is that we have a kind of ritualized response to this, where we are essentially becoming good victims. I hate to use that phrase, but there's a desired psychological response that the mass shooting is supposed to evoke. And part of my criticism of the obsessive focus that the public has on these events is that it plays into that desire to kind of become good victims. One of the things that I emphasized in my original piece is that you essentially have this self-perpetuating script or template or story that has been created so that anybody who is angry can go out and follow the script, right? So the thing that we need to figure out is either how to decrease the power of that script. And I think part of that is by decreasing the saturation and the sensationalism of the reporting. But another way might be to actually change the script or show ways of breaking it. And I think we are actually maybe seeing something like that happening right now with the way that the Parkland students are responding to the shooting. I don't want to get into the content of what the students are saying. A lot of that is, debatable.
Yeah, yeah.
But the interesting thing about it is that they're being very bad victims, right? The way that a victim is supposed to behave and that the public is supposed to behave is to be terrorized, to say this is senseless, to say, we feel helpless and there's nothing that we can do. And so I think one of the things that I found fascinating about the Parkland students' response is that they are not behaving in a way as if they are helpless. And I wonder if that may turn out to dampen some of the power of the script.
It's really interesting to me because I look at it in a different way, and I've never thought of it your way. And it'll be interesting to watch because I've thought of it as if you wanted to make a bunch of victims, then you lose. But if you wanted to forward a movement, you could count on that happening because of the emotion of it's so connected to the emotion, and there's so much attention to this now that, you know, the shooter, whether this was his intention or not, and I don't think it was, I think he was nuts. There is action, and the country has stopped because of his deed.
Yes. I think that there are two different ways that you can see the way that the country is responding as a success or a failure in terms of what this shooter was attempting to achieve.
We have about a minute
that we can understand that. Okay. I think you can say that and to one extent it's successful because we're all talking about it a lot. To another extent, it's not successful because we aren't responding in the way that we are really supposed to.
Yeah. Okay. Ari, thank you so much. And when you have, you know, new thoughts, we would love to hear it. We want to try to be responsible and do the things that we can instead of just telling everybody else what they can do. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much for having me.
You bet. It's Ari Shulman. He wrote an article for The Wall Street Journal, What Mass Killers Want and How to Stop Them. And it's really aimed towards the media.
Glenn Beck.
So Jared Kushner and the terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day that he had yesterday. Tuesday was not really kind to the president's son-in-law. Kushner may have felt that he was living out in real time the day made famous in the children's book and in the movie, where Alexander goes to sleep with gum in his mouth and wakes up with gum in his hair. Kushner went to sleep with a top secret clearance and woke up with a downgrade to just plain old secret, which is a really big deal for the things that he is working on. However, I mean, it means that his high-level stuff has to be worked on, but it is not unusual for a security clearance to take this long. Now, that was just the beginning of his day. Media reports started coming out stating that officials from four different countries have discussed ways that Jared Kushner might be manipulated. Sources told the Washington Post that these ways of manipulation include taking advantage of Kushner's complex business arrangements and his family debt. Oh. Okay, but did they? Was anyone doing that? Or is this the Washington Post saying, hypothetically, these things could happen? We talked to people in four different countries. I mean, it sounds bad, but can we pump the brakes here for a second? First of all, Kushner may still eventually get the top secret clearance. He's been downgraded to secret in the meantime. The process to obtain a top secret clearance takes sometimes a very long time, depending on how much information the investigators have to go through. The top two things that tie top secret clearance are meetings with foreign nationals and financial debt. Well, he's got a ton of both of those. And for anybody waving the, you see, he's guilty flag, this process is normal. Normal. Secondly, I'm having a hard time understanding why the Washington Post ran the story that four countries had discussed ways that they might be able to manipulate the president's son-in-law. Are they thinking about doing that? If so, maybe we should know which countries those are. I mean, are rival nations looking for ways to gain leverage? And if they are, wait. No. I mean, I wish I could show you my shocked face here on the radio, but your shocked face is probably the same. If those four countries are actually trying to do something or were successful in manipulating him, then it would be a story. Other than that, this story is meaningless.
Glenn Beck. Mercury. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Okay, there's something we all have to learn because there's a new talking point. It's always great when you get these new talking points because everybody starts to say the same thing on television all at once. Same day. All of a sudden, everybody is saying exactly the same thing. Here's the new talking point.
business interests, including the 666 Fifth Avenue property in New York.
They were close to getting the company to invest in the 666 Fifth Avenue property.
Is there at least a circumstantial case here that some of what these meetings were about was 666 Fifth Avenue?
You see the same ability to try and have vulnerability with Kushner over the 666 building that perhaps...
Trump's son-in-law has a 41-story size problem at 666 Fifth Avenue. Jared Kushner's company still...
Walk into the office at 666 Fifth Avenue.
666 Fifth Avenue.
666 Fifth Avenue.
666 Fifth Avenue.
The building in New York... On Fifth Avenue, that's the address is 666.
Find out who is in possession of some of these properties, especially 666 Fifth Avenue.
Well, clearly the devil owns 666 Fifth Avenue. Who else is living there?
I mean, Jared should have known it was bad luck to buy 666 Fifth Avenue. But that's what they're saying is because he has debt on this property. It was the most expensive office building ever purchased in New York when he bought it, I think in 2007. And so now they're saying what he's been looking around the world to get financing for the building and everything. This is back before he was in the White House. And they're saying this is a pressure point on Jared Kushner. And it came out in the Washington Post story, that address. And then everybody on cable news is repeating 666 Fifth Avenue. And immediately, as soon as that story comes out, it's a big talking point, and everybody mentions it over and over and over and over again.
Well, you know, this is not a right talking point, because we would have said, see, there's connections there to the Antichrist. I'm just telling you. I mean, if the right would have had 666 Fifth Avenue, we would have at least had fun with it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not happening. Pat Gray, welcome to the program. On your mind today?
Many things, but maybe the top of my list right now is Ryan Seacrest. First of all, Ryan Seacrest was accused by his hairstylist, or the person that does his makeup at E.
For 6 years.
Yeah. And she claimed that he sexually harassed her on a regular basis. So quietly, E did an investigation. I think they handled it right. You know, mm-hmm. they mm-hmm. didn't suspend him. They just waited to see what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. They found zero evidence that what she said was true.
Zero.
And he kept going. Mm-hmm. And Seacrest talked about it. He put it on his Facebook post, or, put out a story.
And he said, I didn't do this. This is not true, but I'm cooperating with, whatever the company wants to do, I will cooperate.
And he did.
He did.
And they found no evidence.
Zero.
And now it's everywhere all of a sudden. And now they're talking about public relations people are advising their clients not to go anywhere near him at the Oscars because he has the red carpet thing, the interviews that he does.
No, jeez.
And so the PR people are saying, why would you even take that chance? He's been accused. So go to the other person or go to some other outlet.
He's been cleared. He's been accused. Are you now, or have you ever been, a member of the Communist Party?
If this isn't a worse McCarthyism than we had in the 50s, it's getting as bad.
It's getting as bad, except that did have the power of the government to put you in jail.
Very true.
This is just destroying your life.
And witch hunt is appropriate on this. There's an ABC star, Bellamy Young. She's on Scandal. She said, I think this is the time for Ryan Seacrest to step aside and let someone of equal talent that is beyond reproach to be in charge. First of all, the guy has every job in the world. There's nobody of equal talent.
I'm sincere about that. I think he's one of the most smartest guys around.
He's really good.
He's really good.
And how aren't you above reproach if you've been cleared of any wrongdoing? That seems to be...
No, you never get to go back.
I guess not.
You never get to go back.
You're just totally tainted now. Forever, because somebody accused you. Let's keep in mind, anybody can accuse anybody else of wrongdoing.
And then I have a llama in the wings right now that's going to swear out a testimony about Pat. And if you want me to bring the llama out, I will.
If you actually had a llama, I'd be nervous.
But once that llama does what llamas do, barks or whatever they do. Mm-hmm. It can't be unbarked, Pat. It can't be unbarked.
Scary.
You know what's interesting? You're talking about how people can be accused, and it's always, they're always tainted with it. Now
and
we're
it's
in
over.
The Me Too era, right? It's over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one accusation that has had no attention since the Me Too movement has started?
I bet I'm going to say the same thing.
Are you really?
Yeah.
I don't know. I was going to say Al Gore's second chakra. Remember?
Oh,
remember
wow.
this?
Wow.
Remember the
That's
accusation by the masseuse
yeah.
who said that Al Gore was constantly trying to get him to touch her?
Yeah.
To
I want you to adjust my second chakra.
Right. Remember
it's
this?
Because of our SUV that my chakra's out of place.
So, yeah,
That's
he was trying
strange.
To get her to do things to him in regions she didn't want to touch.
And she complained about it, and it was brushed
wow.
off by the
That's
media
right.
completely.
So,
he has not faced word one of a second
nope.
thought on this
wow.
over that time. And Bill Clinton has, right? I mean, there have been
yeah,
a lot of
yeah.
people on the left who said, okay, we handled that Clinton thing wrongly. But, I mean, one accusation has been enough for almost everybody.
And that wasn't 30 years ago. That was 8 years ago.
Yeah.
That was in 2010.
Was it 2010?
Yeah.
I knew it was late 2000s.
Yep.
So let me go where I was going to go. Jimmy Kimmel. Jimmy Kimmel is hosting the Oscars. Not outside like Ryan Seacrest. He's hosting the Oscars.
Has he been accused?
Have you seen any of the videotapes of what he's done?
I mean, he used to host a show called The Man Show.
Yeah,
oh,
he
man.
Did a, he did a, wow. I'm going to put something in my pants, and you can feel around to see what it is. You might want to use your mouth. Okay?
Yes.
He's on
wow.
video doing that.
Yep, over and over. I mean, it was part of that show. Look, and I defend that show at that time, and I, you know, they did
no
things,
way.
But they did things that were funny, right? It was funny, and it was totally fine.
Sorry, it's retroactively inappropriate.
It's retroactively inappropriate, however.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, remember, this is the show that ended every episode with girls jumping on trampolines in their underwear. Every episode ended the same way. That was literally the last sentence of every show. And now girls jumping on trampolines.
And he's the guy that's
wow.
totally okay to host the Oscars. I mean, yeah. you want to talk
nobody's,
about...
Nobody said a thing.
There's two things. There's two people, two organizations that have made a choice today, and I don't think it's going to end well for either of them. Dick's Sporting Goods.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Saying, we're not going to carry, you know...
AR-15s.
We're standing against these things. We're going to... You can't buy a gun until you're 21. I don't think that's going to play in the heartland of America.
Even though everybody's jumping on Walmart now to do the same, which... They did back in 2015.
Well, if they do that for the hysteria, maybe. I don't agree with it, but maybe. That's what Dix did last time. Dix did, you know, a temporary. We're just going to take them off the shelves and just let the heat go away. Okay? So you kind of understand that. But Cabela's, I don't think Cabela's is going to do that. And if I can go buy a gun at Cabela's and I have Dix who is... You know, I want to buy a gun that's not an AR. I'm not going to go buy it at Dick's.
No, I'm going to go to Cabela's.
They've made the choice. The other organization is the Oscars. They have taken a guy, now see if this sounds familiar, a guy who has called the president all kinds of names, a guy who has made passionate, sometimes unstable-seeming pleas on his own show. He has cried on three different occasions, three different shows, while making pleas about politics.
And I thought that was a bad thing.
It's a bad thing.
Yeah.
They have now said, you are the guy, by the way, in the middle of the Me Too thing, also has his history, you're the guy to host the Oscars. The Oscars has zero chance, when you have Jimmy Fallon available. How do you expect to get people in the center of the country who disagree with you to watch the Oscars? If I were ABC, I'd be pissed. I know it's your guy, but I'd really be pissed.
Yeah.
Because I just spent a fortune to have the Oscars, and now you're going to strap me with this guy who's going to turn off half of the country.
Mm-hmm.
It's just foolish.
Mm-hmm.
Just foolish.
We have some audio from Jimmy Kimmel talking about this. You want to hear it?
Yeah, go ahead.
This is Jimmy Kimmel talking about what he said about the GOP and Donald Trump.
Do you think that maybe there have been times where you push the envelope too far and maybe become a little too political?
No, I don't. No,
you don't regret anything that you've said?
Mm-mm. Not at all. I don't think you can go too far. I think that...
Can you imagine if I would have said that?
I'm still doing a comedy show, and I need to be funny and entertain my audience. But I also think that we've matured enough to the point where we can accept late-night talk show hosts speaking about a serious subject. And I think that it's almost necessary now.
But can we accept talk show hosts making jokes?
Yeah, I don't know.
No,
I mean, I
could,
I accepted it from Jimmy Kimmel when he was doing The Man Show. I mean, you know, it was a joke. We all understood it was in that context. Now, I don't know if that's true. But, I mean, you know, Kimmel has always talked about serious issues on that show. One of the things that made Kimmel, I think, a really strong late-night host is we used to play his audio all the time of people who thought... who didn't understand Obamacare and who didn't, you know, understand these big Obama pushes. And he took time to mock them as well. You know, he used to do that. And what's happened is he's had a personal incident that has made him very emotional about healthcare and has set him off on this, you know, sort of snowball effect. Where now that's all he can think about. And he's completely obsessed, despite knowing almost nothing about the topics he's talking about.
It's very Letterman-esque. Same thing happened to David Letterman with the war. It made him bitter and angry.
And awful.
And awful. And you unwatchable to anybody on the right. And so that I think that same thing is going on with Kimmel now.
Do you want to... We also have him talking about... I don't know. You want this striking the right tone at the Oscars? Want to hear this real quick?
Yeah, let me hear that.
Nervous at all that you're going to strike the right tone?
Yeah, that I do worry about that because I have a tendency to not strike the right tone. In my life. And so I, you know, I do think about that.
How will you know if you've gone too far?
I'm sure the internet will tell me.
He just said he can't
in
go
real
too
time.
Far.
Right.
Yes, almost immediately.
So you probably saw there was a USA Today poll that was released recently that said 94% of women in Hollywood have been harassed or assaulted. That's your audience right there.
It's, yeah.
How do you address it?
Well, listen, here's the thing. This show is not about reliving people's sexual assaults. It's an award show for people who have been dreaming about maybe winning an Oscar for their whole lives. And the last thing I want to do is ruin that for someone who is, you know, nominated for, you know, best leading actress or best supporting or best director.
We can stop right here because I'm just listening to this and I'm like, I don't care about any of the stuff about the Oscars. I really don't.
It's tough.
I just don't care about it at all. Not going to watch it. Don't care. I do care about Ryan Seacrest.
I do too.
And that is Oscar related because here's a guy who has been cleared by an investigation and just one person saying he was coming on to me all the time. He was sexually harassing me. Even though the company looked into it and did an extensive evaluation in today's atmosphere, finds him clean, they're still wanting to drum him out of business.
It's wrong.
Thanks, Pat.
Pat Gray Unleashed is on The Blaze every day, right after this program. The Blaze Radio and The Blaze TV. You can also subscribe to the podcast. You can get anywhere you get podcasts, including iTunes.
And at 5:30 tonight, you don't want to miss it. We have a 5 o'clock show, me at the chalkboard, and then at 5:30, the news and why it matters that you don't want to miss. If you haven't seen it yet, you're going to love it.
Glenn Beck.
Make sure you grab a copy of Control, the book that we wrote about gun control. It's available at Amazon. I think it's going back to press because the book has been sold out now at Amazon. But you can also get it for Kindle and everything else. But it is a really good book. And I say that because, you know, I didn't write all of it. I wrote it with
John Lott
and there was another guy. I can't remember now.
Yeah, the guy who wrote the On Killing, right?
Yes. Lieutenant Grossman, who is just—they're amazing. They're amazing. So please, it is a great book to read if you want to defend the Second Amendment. I got an email in about Cruz's neighbor begging cops to step in after reporting his dark behavior. A lot of people are saying, Glenn, you can't arrest somebody for what they might do. No, you're right. But when there is this much evidence, that many people speaking out, we need to do more.
Glenn Beck, Mercury.